Mustafa Sahin is from Boston Children's Hospital, and he'll tell us about autism and tuberous sclerosis and bring us back to the human.
I also want to thank Takao for organizing this group of talks. I've learned a lot in the last hour and a half. And what I'd like to do in the next 25 minutes is to tell you about some of the work we've been doing in my lab, focusing on one single disorder, tuberous sclerosis, and trying to get some insights into the both cell biology and circuitry underlying autism disorders. What I'd like to start with is to tell you why we chose tuberous sclerosis as a model to study for autism. There are really four reasons. First of all, approximately 50% of the patients with tuberous sclerosis develop autism spectrum disorder symptoms. Importantly, many of the patients with tuberous sclerosis may be diagnosed before birth or at the time of birth because of the heart tumors that these patients develop. And I would argue that the cellular mechanisms aberrant in TSC are starting to be understood, and probably understood at a deeper level than many of the other disorders that result in autism. And finally, and very luckily, there are several FDA-approved specific inhibitors of this pathway, the mTOR pathway, that have been used in other diseases and that can be repurposed to study in tuberous sclerosis. So this combination of four factors, I think, makes tuberous sclerosis a really good model to study in terms of autism. So what is tuberous sclerosis? It's an autosomal dominant disease that causes benign tumors in the brain, in the heart, in the skin, kidneys, and in the eye. It presents to child neurologists like myself because the patients develop seizures. Approximately 90% of them will have seizures sometime in their life. They also have symptoms of autism spectrum disorder and intellectual disability. Its incidence is thought to be around 1 in 6,000 to 1 in 10,000 newborns. So we estimate there are about 1 million people worldwide affected with this disease. The genes TSC1 and TSC2 encode for Hamartin and Tuberin respectively, and these genes have been identified since the mid-90s. If you look at the neuropathology of tuberous sclerosis, the hallmark is the presence of these cortical tubers that are shown on this MRI scan here. And under the microscope, or under at the time of autopsy, what we see is the thickening of the cortex and loss of myelination under those tubers as the neuropathological manifestations of this disease. At the microscopic level, the hallmark of the disease is the presence of these giant cells, which can be about 150 microns to 200 microns in diameter, about the 10 times the size of a normal neuron. And it turns out in all organisms in which TSC1 and TSC2 genes are lost, you get enlargement of the cells. So here's an example from the fruit fly. The whole eye of the fruit fly is bigger. Ommatidia that make up the eye are bigger compared to wild-type ommatidia nearby. And the hair cells on the back of the fly are bigger. So any cell that's missing TSC1 or TSC2 genes grows larger. Why does this happen? I think this pathway has been introduced by Peter before, but I want to put it in the context of TSC. And this is due to the activation of the Rheb-mTOR pathway. So in all cells that have been evolutionarily conserved, this pathway seems to be regulating protein synthesis. So when this GTPase called Rheb and this kinase called mTOR, which stands for mammalian target of rapamycin, are active, you turn on a machinery that results in increased protein synthesis and enlargement of cell size. What TSC1 and TSC2 proteins do is to form a heterodimeric complex that puts a brake on this GTPase Rheb. In fact, TSC2 turns out to be a GTPase activating protein for this GTPase Rheb. As you can imagine, if either TSC1 or TSC2 are non-functional in the cell, then you have overactivity of this pathway, too much protein synthesis, and too much cell growth. Cells actually have taken advantage of this evolutionary conserved pathway in several ways. So growth factors such as insulin or BDNF turn on a kinase called AKT, which phosphorylates TSC2 on a certain set of residues and inhibits it. That allows the mTOR pathway to be active, and it finally results in cell growth. So growth factors work through TSC to increase cell size. Conversely, the amount of energy in the cell does the opposite. So if you break down your ATP to AMP, then you turn on a kinase called AMP kinase that phosphorylates TSC2 on a different set of residues and activates this complex. So that puts a brake on Rheb and mTOR and puts a brake on protein synthesis. So a starving cell doesn't continue to grow. An important implication of the identification of the relationship between TST and mTOR has been the fact that we now have a very specific inhibitor of this pathway, the rapamycin, a compound that's been used in the clinic for almost 2 decades, actually turns out to inhibit this kinase, mTOR, very specifically. So that has really changed the landscape of TST research in the last 10 years. One of the first questions we were interested in when we started studying TST was, what is the true incidence of autism spectrum in the TST patients? If you look at the literature, retrospective studies report ranges starting from 17% to 80%. So Shefali Jasti, who was then a behavioral neurology fellow at Boston Children's, collaborated with Patrick Bolton and Eli Humphrey in England, who had been following a cohort of children from infancy with tuberous sclerosis. And what they had was behavioral assessments and ADAS on children as early as 2 years of age, up to 5 years of age. So what Shefali did was to look at the incidence of autism spectrum in this group of children. And to make a long story short, what she found was that approximately 20% of the children fulfilled full criteria for autism, under 30% fulfilled criteria for autism spectrum disorders. And the other 50% were not affected by these symptoms. They were not in the spectrum. So this raises a very interesting question for a neurobiologist: why, with the same single gene disorder, or essentially two genes resulting in the same disease, why you have half of the patients affected with autism and half of them not affected with autism spectrum disorder? So this is the question we've been puzzling with. In the literature, most of the data looking at the relationship between autism and tuberous sclerosis has focused on the cortical tubers. And a very nice study by Patrick Bolton and colleagues about 10 years ago suggested that cortical tubers in bilateral temporal lobes were necessary but not sufficient for developing autism spectrum disorders in TSC. Unfortunately, several other studies have failed to show a similar correlation, and other, you know, some of the studies have implicated frontal lobe tubers, others have implicated cerebellar tubers. So I think the jury is still out with respect to the relationship between cortical tubers and the development of autistic symptoms. And in fact, in my practice, I have a very hard time looking at conventional MRI pictures of patients with tuberous sclerosis and decide who's going to be more severely affected and who's going to be less severely affected. Here are two images from two children from my clinic. This is a 17-year-old boy who has mild learning disabilities and is in an integrated class in high school. Here's an image from an 18-year-old girl which seems to have relatively similar cortical tuber load, but she is nonverbal and autistic. So just looking at conventional MRI, it's very hard to draw conclusions about the outcome. So instead of focusing on these white spots, the cortical tubers, we've decided to focus on the rest of the brain in TSC patients. And we have been wondering whether we could use alternative imaging techniques such as diffusion tensor imaging MRI to look at the connectivity of the different brain regions. And I'll come back to this at the end of the talk. Unfortunately, in studies in human subjects is not very helpful in terms of looking at the mechanisms of abnormalities at the cellular and circuit level. So instead, we've decided to pursue this hypothesis in rodent models. And our hypothesis is that miswiring of neural connectivity could contribute to the pathogenesis of tuberous sclerosis in the brain. So over the last several years, we've done experiments in various aspects of neural connectivity, and most of this work is published. So we looked at axon specification, axon guidance, and myelination, and more recently into the circuitry. So just to briefly summarize this work, we showed that TSC1 and TSC2 proteins and the mTOR pathway components are expressed at very high levels in developing axons. And if you delete both alleles of TSC1 or both alleles of TSC2, you end up with neurons that have multiple axons, a phenotype that's never seen in CNS neurons. So you can have hippocampal cells with two axons, for instance. Now, this phenotype, the effect of TSC1 and TSC2 genes, seems to only happen when the cells are null for TSC1 or TSC2. However, since this is an autosomal dominant disease, most of the brain cells of a patient with tuberous sclerosis are haploinsufficient for TSC1 or TSC2. So we looked at other abnormalities in axon targeting, and we showed that there were abnormalities in the heterozygous case of projections of retinal ganglion cells to the thalamus, for instance. So even missing one copy of TSC1 or TSC2 seems to be sufficient for topographic mapping in the brain. And then importantly, loss of TST in neurons seems to be sufficient to result in a hypomyelination phenotype. So when you miss TSC function in the neurons or in the axons, you have some kind of abnormality in the signaling to the oligodendrocytes that results in a loss of myelination. And this defect can be reversed by treatment with rapamycin. And more recently, we've been focusing on the neural circuitry that could underlie some of the behavioral abnormalities that we see in the patients with tuberous sclerosis. So we decided to do region-specific knockouts of TSC1 gene and see if we could recapitulate some of the abnormalities that we were seeing in the patients. So the work that I'm going to describe to you is done by Peter Tsai, who's a very talented child neurologist in the lab. And when Peter came to the lab, he decided to focus on the cerebellum. And I think from the three talks we've heard so far, the reason is clear that there are many non-motor functions of the cerebellum that have been implicated. And in particular, the work that Kathy Limperopoulos did at Boston Children's, showing that specific lesions in the cerebellum in newborns are associated with a very high risk of developing subsequent autism spectrum symptoms, really motivated us to look at the cerebellum more carefully. Importantly, in terms of tuberous sclerosis, there are interesting associations between cerebellar lesions and behavioral abnormalities. First of all, approximately a third of the patients with tuberous sclerosis have cerebellar lesions, even though as a neurologist you may not be able to detect these by bedside testing on motor examination. And then there are at least two papers in the literature that have correlated cerebellar lesions with the presence of autistic symptoms in the patients. And finally, and very interestingly, a study by Harry Shugani's lab showed that hypermetabolism in the deep cerebellar nuclei by PET scanning correlated with the presence of autistic symptoms in the TSC patients. So as you know, cerebellar cortex inhibits normally the deep cerebellar nuclei, so hypermetabolism in the deep cerebellar nuclei in this case would suggest that there was hypofunction of the cerebellar cortex, and that seemed to go along with autism symptoms in the TSC patients. So motivated by these studies, we decided to pursue the hypothesis that cerebellar dysfunction could contribute to the pathogenesis of autistic-like behaviors in TSC. So Peter generated this Purkinje-specific mutant of TSC1 by using the AL7 Cre. This turns on recombination by postnatal ACE6. These animals are born at the expected frequency. They have normal lifespans, and they have weights that are comparable to their litter mates, so they're relatively healthy. We wanted to make sure that the knockout was really specific to the Purkinje cells, so we used a marker, as shown by blue staining here, showing where the Cre expression was occurring. And as you can see, the vast majority of the blue staining is in the Purkinje cells in the cerebellum. There are very few scattered cells throughout the rest of the brain. So this is really a truly Purkinje cell-specific mutant of TSC1. As you can imagine, if TSC1 is not functional, then you should have upregulation of mTOR pathway, and you can see that by staining with an antibody to phospho-S6, which is a downstream marker of mTOR. And what they showed was that the staining with this antibody showed that there was increased mTOR activity just in the Purkinje cell layer, but not in the rest of the brain, again showing that this manipulation was really specific to the Purkinje cells. After that, Peter looked at what happens to these Purkinje cells when they lose the TSC1 gene. It turns out in the heterozygous case, we don't see any change in the Purkinje cell number or cell size. But in the mutant case, in this case where we are missing both alleles of TSC1, the Purkinje cells get enlarged, and they are reduced in number. And we start seeing that somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks of life in these mice, and by 4 months, they are down to about a quarter of their normal number. We wondered why these cells were dying, but it turns out these cells have a cleaved caspase staining suggesting that they are dying by apoptosis. Previously, we had shown in hippocampal neurons that TSC1 or TSC2 loss resulted in neuronal stress responses, either oxidative stress or endoplasmic reticulum stress or ER stress. So we looked for markers of ER stress and oxidative stress in these Purkinje cells, and we see GRP76, 78, and hemoxygenase 1 staining in these Purkinje cells, suggesting that ER stress and oxidative stress are probably the reason that these cells are dying. So then Peter asks, what is the behavioral phenotype of these mice? And this is the three-chamber apparatus developed by Jackie Crawley and colleagues. In this simple test, you put the mice in the middle chamber, allow it to habituate for about 10 minutes, and then allow it to explore two chambers, one with a live mouse in it and another one with an object in it. And normal mice, control mice, prefer to spend more time with the live animal than the object. And in the second stage of this experiment, you put a novel mouse in the empty chamber, and they allow the mice to make a choice between the new mouse versus the familiar mice. So we used this test on our Purkinje-specific TSC mutants. As you can see in the control case, as expected, the animals preferred the animal over the object. However, our heterozygous mutants or the null mutants did not show the same preference. In the second stage of the test, we brought in a novel mouse in the alternative chamber, and the control mice spent more time with the novel animal versus the familiar animal. Our heterozygous and mutants did not show a statistically significant difference between the novel versus the familiar animal. So in both social approach and social novelty, Purkinje cell-specific TSC1 mutants failed to show the preference that the control litter may show. We wonder, could this be due to locomotor defects? As you can imagine, especially the null mutants lose their Purkinje cells and develop ataxia around 8 weeks of life. So we looked at the locomotion of these animals by looking at the distance traveled, and there was really no statistical difference between the three genotypes. So we don't think the locomotion is responsible for this social interaction phenotype. A second aspect of autistic-like behaviors in the mice is repetitive behaviors, and one way to look at this is to look at grooming, self-grooming. And when we look at the time that these animals spent grooming themselves, both the heterozygous and the null mutants showed a significantly increased self-grooming compared to the control litter mates. An alternative way to look at repetitive behaviors and restricted interest is to a test called reversal learning. You essentially use a water tea maze and teach the mouse where the platform is in the water tea maze. Then after 3 days, you change the location of the platform and essentially ask the mice to forget the original location and relearn a new location for the platform. And in this test, our heterozygous and mutant mice did not have any deficits in learning the initial location of the platform, but when the platform was location was reversed, especially the mutant mice showed a deficit, suggesting that they had abnormalities with repetitive behaviors. And a final aspect of autism spectrum disorder like behavior in the mice is vocalizations. And of course, for mice, it's the ultrasonic vocalizations. Lily Jan's group previously had shown that TSC heterozygous mice have abnormalities in ultrasonic vocalizations. So we wondered whether our Purkinje cell-specific TSC1 mutants showed any abnormalities in vocalizations. And both the heterozygous and the null mutants show abnormalities in ultrasonic vocalization generation just by missing TSC1 in the Purkinje cells. So it turns out that we can replicate all three autistic-like behaviors in the mouse with just loss of TSC1 in the Purkinje cells. So, of course, we want to look at more objectively in the physiology of this effect. So we collaborated with Wade Regier at the Harvard Medical School, who recorded from these Purkinje cells from the three different genotypes. And as you can see, both at rest and when injected with current, the mutant cells are much less active, much less excitable compared to the control cells. We also looked at the morphology of these cells by either calbinin staining or by injecting dye into these cells. And what you can see is that there were abnormalities in the axons as well as in the dendrites of Purkinje cells missing the TSC1 gene. What we saw was that Purkinje cell axons missing TSC1 made these abnormal branches, abnormal turns. They also had these varicosities along the axons. And on the dendritic side, the whole dendritic tree was abnormally oriented, and there were abnormalities in both the density and the length of the dendritic spines, as you can see here. And importantly, this dendritic spine abnormality is also seen in the Fragile X mutants in the Purkinje cells. So Peter wondered whether we could treat these mice with an mTOR inhibitor, in this case rifamycin, and could block the development of these pathological and behavioral symptoms that we were seeing. So he started treating these mice from P7, which is essentially when the Cre gene is being turned on. And what we found was that compared to untreated mice, which lose their Purkinje cells, treated mutants of TSC1 have all of their Purkinje cells surviving. And in the social approach assay, untreated mutants show this inability to differentiate between an animal versus the object. However, after treatment, the mutants show the same preference for the animal over the object as shown in the treated controls. And similarly, in the water T-maze experiment, there was a deficit on reversal day in the mutants that are untreated, but after treatment, mutants seem to figure out the location of the new platform without difficulty. So the effects that we have seen in the mutation in the Purkinje cells can be prevented by treatment with rapamycin starting at T7. So everything I've told you so far is done in the mouse models. And let me just summarize briefly both our previous work as well as this part of the Purkinje cell circuitry that I told you about so far. So we've shown in the previous experiments that the TSC pathway components, TSC1, TSC2, and mTOR, are expressed in the axons, are important for polarity and guidance of these axons, and also for their myelination. But importantly, with size experiments, I think what we have strong evidence for is that Purkinje cells are a crucial part of the neural circuitry underlying autistic-like behaviors in mice. So, of course, at the end of the day, what we want to do is to apply these findings from the mouse models to patients with tuberous sclerosis. And as you know, one of the strong hypotheses in this field is that autism is a developmental disconnection syndrome, that there might be abnormalities, either over-connectivity or under-connectivity, in different regions of the brain that are underlying language and social behavior. Now, if this is true, then I think our data from the mouse models, both in terms of axonal targeting, axonal myelination, and in the cerebellar circuitry that I mentioned, all fit into this kind of a paradigm. But very importantly, TSC is unique among the autism spectrum disorders that we see in the clinic, in the sense that many of the patients can be diagnosed with TSC either before birth or at the time of birth because of the presence of these cardiac tumors, as shown on this fetal echocardiogram. Among fetuses or newborns born with multiple cardiac tumors, the chance of having tuberous sclerosis is about 95%. So even without doing any genetic testing, we have a biomarker, an imaging biomarker, for making a diagnosis of a disease, TSC, which is a high risk for developing autism. So we wanted to use this finding and ask a very simple question. Can we detect which infants born with TSC will go on to develop autism? So this is a study that we started with Simon Warfield, Shefal Jesty, and Chuck Nelson at Boston Children's. And we've been doing this collecting infants born with TSC for several years now, and performing neurocognitive assessment of the infants, diffusion tensor imaging, and neurophysiological assessment of phase processing using ERP paradigms in Chuck's lab. What I want to show you right now is one study, one aspect of that ongoing study, and this was diffusion tensor imaging in patients with tuberous sclerosis. So here are three groups that Jurian Peters studied recently and published last year. The three groups are typically developing children, age-matched TSC subjects with no signs of autism, and then finally TSC children with autism spectrum disorder. And what he did was to look at corpus callosum in a three-dimensional region of interest, as a three-dimensional region of interest, and look at the connectivity within the corpus callosum. As you can see visually, there's really no significant difference between these two groups, TSC patients with no signs of autism and the typically developing controls. And diffraction and anisotropy actually is identical in the two groups. However, the TSC patients with autism show much reduced fractional anisotropy and less organization of the corpus callosum. We don't think this is necessarily causal, obviously, for the autistic symptoms per se, but we are starting to look at different regions of the white matter in the brains of patients with tuberous sclerosis. And we have similar findings from the arcuate vesiculus, which we think might be correlated with the language delay that these children have. So this was a single-center study, and we've now expanded this as a multi-center network, which has been now awarded an ACE grant from the NIH. And this is a five-center study now with UCLA, University of Texas at Houston, Cincinnati, Alabama, and Boston Children's, collecting up to 150 infants with tuberous sclerosis. And we'll be performing frequent prospective frequent neurological and behavioral assessments, as well as EEG and MRI on these children, trying to find early markers of this disease, hopefully one day which will allow us to be able to determine which 50% of the children with TSC will be in the high-risk group and which 50% will be in the low-risk group. Of course, this is really important in terms of prognosis to the families. However, it really only matters if we can do something about it. And I think in terms of treatment options, the mTOR inhibitors look very promising so far. So I've showed you data that mTOR inhibitors can improve myelination and seizures in our model. A completely different knockout in glial cells was studied by Michael Wang, and he showed that he can prevent or stop the seizures. Alcino Silva's lab showed that he can improve learning in a mild mouse model of TSC. And then finally, I showed you Peter Tsai's data showing that we can prevent the autistic features in the Purkinje cell-specific knockout of TSC. So what we are also doing now, which is a phase two clinical trial of an mTOR inhibitor in the TSC patients, and this is a study with Cincinnati and Boston. We're enrolling patients between the age of 6 and 21 years of age with an IQ greater than 60, and using a double-blind placebo-controlled trial, we are looking at neurocognitive testing at baseline, 3 months, and 6 months. Our secondary endpoints are autism, seizure disorders, and sleep abnormalities in these patients. So hopefully in the next, the study will be done at the end of this year, and we'll have some data to present next year. So what I'd like to do now is to acknowledge the people that did the work. All of the work I described to you on the Purkinje cells was done by Peter Tsai. And I'd like to also acknowledge our funding sources and our very generous collaborators that enable us to do the work on tuberous sclerosis. Thank you very much. Dan? Sure.
Is it known about Purkinje cell loss, the time course, or in the human? Does it mirror what we've seen in the mouse?
So Dan is asking whether the Purkinje cell loss in the humans mirrors what's seen in the mouse. So we don't actually know if there's a Purkinje cell loss in the TSC patients per se. What we do know is that there are patients with cerebellar tubers on imaging, and they seem to have a higher incidence of autism. So we don't have enough autopsy specimens to be able to ask that question in the TSC population.
A couple questions. In the mice, do you know whether or not treatment later than P7 has any beneficial effects?
Yeah, Peter Tsai is actually here at this meeting, and he's been doing some of those experiments. It looks like treating later may have some beneficial effects as well.
And are there losses of granule neurons in those animals that older ages or not? Do we know?
Not that we can detect so far, but we haven't done that very systematically.
And finally, although we're not using Dilantin much anymore, is there any data on the Purkinje cell loss induced by Dilantin in association with autism?
So the only aspect of that that we've looked at is in TSC patients. We did a study looking at the volume of the cerebellum in TSC patients that was just recently published. And it seems like TSC2 mutation is correlated with a smaller volume of cerebellum in those patients. And in that case, the Dilantin use had no effect as far as we could tell. But we haven't looked at that particular question directly. Thank you.
Okay, thank you again, Mustafa.